dynamics where you had family members come into the party. Mm-hmm. Then you had those dynamics where you had one partner come in and the other one didn't come in. So, you had those struggles and pulls that went on. But because the party was always one who tried to deal with the family and the kids as a collective family, that came a part of the extension of how people themselves who perhaps maybe were in the party and the partner wasn't in the party, still tried to deal with their family as much as they humanly possible. Of course, there was frictions there because of the times and the pressures of being involved in a situation like that. But it was always a priority to deal, try to keep the collective spirit of family together.
Okay, we're going to keep rolling. We're going to listen next to the voice of Mama Charlotte O'Neill, who comes to the Bay Area often, and we'll talk a bit about Mama Charlotte. We'll listen to a little bit from Kathleen Cleaver. We'll come back and talk with our in-studio guest, Greg Bridges, who actually is not really in-studio guest because he's working on the program, and Emory Douglas, the Minister of Culture of the Black Panther Party. And we'll talk a bit about a couple of other people who should be in our minds in terms of brothers who made contributions, freedom fighters who made a contribution. We'll be back and we'll talk about that in a moment. Kathleen Neal Cleaver dropped out of college in 1966 to join the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC, and from 1967 to 1971, she worked as a communications secretary of the Black Panther Party. After sharing years of exile with the late Eldridge Cleaver, she returned to the United States during 1975. Kathleen has devoted decades to win the release of imprisoned freedom fighters, including Geronimo Gijaga Pratt, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who continues his fight against the death sentence, and the late Marilyn Buck, who won parole after 25 years and passed away 3 weeks later in 2010. She is a graduate of Yale Law School. She currently teaches at Emory University Law School and at Yale University. She co-edited Liberation Imagination, the Black Panther Party, more recently edited Target Zero, A Life in Writing, a collection of Eldridge Cleaver's work. She's currently working on the book Memories of Love and War. She joins us to talk about Don Cox, better known as DC, the field marshal of the Black Panther Party, who made his transition on March 2011. Kathleen, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak to you, Walter.
Always. You know, I was looking at something. I know when Emory first heard of the passing of DC, he said, "We lost a great soldier." What were your first thoughts about the transition of Don Cox?
Well, unlike many people, I was in touch with him for a long time. He was living in a very small town, a village, basically a hamlet, in the Pyrenees, in the southern part of France, close to the border with Spain. And he'd been living there for some time. In September, I had mailed him a copy of a chapter I'd written, and also, I put a little letter on the front that had a photograph of Joju, my daughter, and her son, who had turned 7, I think, or 8 that particular day. I knew he wouldn't recognize her, because when he lived in Algeria, when my daughter was born, she was an infant, and he hadn't seen her in a while. So I had sent him this letter, and I'd sent him the chapter, and I talked to him on the phone because I wanted his feedback about what he remembered. And of the 30-some pages, there's only one thing he contested in there, and I had said that he had gone to the U.S. consulate and come back and told us what they had said. And the point of the statement was what they had said. The quote was that, oh, we don't have to worry too much about them. They're killing each other now. And that was in response to a story in the newspaper about the murder of Robert Webb in March of 1971 in broad daylight on the streets of Harlem. And he said to me, I never went to the American consulate. And I asked him, you know, how he was doing. He said he was fine, he had no health problems. And that's kind of how we all thought of him. You know, he's very self-sufficient. He grew his food, he cooked, he took care of himself. He lived in very, very isolated circumstances, and he seemed to want it that way.
You know, Kathleen, when you see pictures of D.C. and, you know, there's a few of them available. When you talk to people I've talked to around this program honoring D.C., they talk about his demeanor. They talk about him being quiet, soft-spoken, when he was at San Francisco State, when he did the national work of the Black Panther Party. He was, in some senses, your family. Talk about, was that D.C.? How did you and D.C. interact? How did you see that?
Well, D.C. was perfectly capable of expressing himself, and he was a very strong individual. He was not a loud person. He didn't tend to make speeches. He wrote articles. Basically, D.C. was a farm boy. He came from somewhere out in the Midwest before he came to San Francisco, and he married, had a family, was working in, I think he was running a print shop or something. He was a middle-class businessman. And it was something that happened during the 60s in San Francisco, and I believe it was a police killing of a young black man. That happened before I had moved out there. And so something had happened that triggered his concern and triggered his interest and made him ready to join the Black Panthers.
When was the first time that you met D.C., Kathleen? You remember the circumstances?
The first time that sticks in my mind is at a meeting in our apartment, Eldridge and my apartment. It was a meeting at which Bobby Seale created the Central Committee because the party was expanding, and at that point, D.C. was acknowledged or named as the field marshal, and I think Eldridge was Minister of Information, and I was named Communications Secretary. So it was in this meeting, and I remember that he was a person who did not say a lot, but he was very present, and he was very confident, and he was a mature individual.
You know, Kathleen, as I was thinking when I was reading about D.C., when I saw that he had passed and he was in his mid-70s, and I was thinking the same thing about the other brother, Sundiata Kohli, that, yeah, they came into the party when they were in their 30s. Talk a bit about that. What's your thoughts about that?
The Black Panther Party was overwhelmingly a youth movement and youth-oriented and had youthful energy, which made it believe, as most young people do, that they're indestructible, no matter what.
Okay.
Whereas mature people have a sense of, in order to accomplish a particular objective, you need to plan it. You have to think about what you want to accomplish, how you're going to do it, what resources you need, and then going about putting that together. And I think the people, D.C. and Eldridge and Bobby Seale, who are older than teenagers and who had life experiences, would bring that ability to think through and plan for the same purposes that the tremendously young, enthusiastic warriors and young people came into the party full of a desire just to do it now, you know, ready or not, here we come. And there's some overlap. I mean, I'm not saying that people in their 30s didn't have that same desire of the people who were teenagers. It's just they had a different method. I just wanted to tell you something that Denise Oliver, who arrived at the international section, was met at the airport by D.C. and Sekou. Now, she says about him, she says, I knew his face from the Panther paper, and I had met him once. This was D.C., Donald Cox, field marshal of the Black Panther Party, a brother I'd never met but was a legend in the New York branch. D.C. was imposing. He had the quality of so many large, quiet men of inspiring awe with no effort. And this is her response. His resemblance to a lion made me rather hesitant to say anything much to him.
Kathleen, talk about those difficult years. I was reading an interview that D.C. did with Safia, and he was talking about 1971 as being a very difficult year. But, of course, COINTELPRO and the FBI were heavy on the case of anybody who represented Chase.
Well, it was difficult in the sense that the party that he had invested so much in, right. Eldridge had invested so much in, I had invested so much in, and now we were isolated from it physically in Algiers and had established an international office. It was the international section of the Black Panther Party. It had the support of the Algerian government and the diplomatic community of, you know, radical revolutionary states to have the COINTELPRO operations take place during that moment and have the international, the Central Committee members who were at the international section, which is D.C., me, and Eldridge, be expelled by Huey Newton, sort of by fiat. It's incoherent. How can one part of the Central Committee expel the other? So you have a split in the party and challenges to alliance, and that was a very destructive thing to happen. It was also very confusing for people who weren't a part of that division. You know, like, well, we supported both people. Why should we have to make a choice? So the financial circumstances became very difficult because of the complex needs to support a whole community of people in a collective manner in Algiers with a very limited sources of income. Part of the income came from solidarity groups. Part of it came from Eldridge's writings. But, the income wasn't there. The political climate was shifting. And so those are the things that are difficult. D.C. eventually went underground. Many people left. And ultimately, the international section closed in a couple of years. So it was sort of the end of a moment.
How did you, I mean, you were talking about how you were addressing it financially, the difficulties and the sense of isolation, but for people like yourselves who you'd been in SNCC and Eldridge had been writing in D.C. and all these people had been active, and now you found that the component that you most dreamed about, how do you manage that on a day-to-day basis? It's something, it's ending, it's over with, or it looks like it's ending.
Well, you just have to roll with that. That's what's going on. I mean, it wasn't the first organization that had ended that I had been a part of. It probably wasn't the first organization that ended Eldridge had been a part of, and he'd been in other organizations. You have splits, you have divisions. What was difficult is the isolation from the United States, so not being in a position to gain support directly from the community you're in. You're sort of separated from the support system. So it's stressful and it's isolating because you can't really discuss it with a lot of people. But once you've made a commitment to engage in revolutionary struggle, particularly if you are in a moment such as the one D.C. and Eldridge and I and other people in the international section were in that very, very early moment, 1970, 1971, looking at armed struggle, looking at gun battles, looking at people being shot in the streets, looking at people being facing death penalty in court. We weren't people who thought we had any long life guarantee. So that wasn't the difficulty. That's the reality of our lives. We were people who admired immensely and studied the Battle of Algiers. And as you know, that in that film, the victory comes after the death of the people who are the militants. We had devoted our lives to the struggle. What's difficult is how do you continue when the organizational apparatus that you are part of has turned against you, and you are not really in a position. So we started another newspaper called Babylon Then Write On, and we started the Revolutionary People's Communication Network, and we challenged this division, and there, you know, the political energy of the Black Panther Party didn't stop. Gotcha. It was frustrated in one sense. There are few revolutionary struggles that don't experience some type of division on this level, and the government took advantage of those fractures to serve their own purpose.
How do you assess, Kathleen, how do you assess D.C.'s legacy, his contribution? When you think back and say, you know, D.C. meant this and D.C. will always mean that, because you knew him, you worked with him. How do you assess where we put D.C. in kind of the context of understanding what we've been through as a people, as a community?
Well, that's a big question, because D.C. as a presence is one thing. D.C. as a writer, D.C. as a leader. D.C. was a person that most of the comrades and colleagues and supporters knew as very level-headed. He was admired. He was loved. He was a legend. He's one of those revolutionary figures who will always symbolize, because the images that people have of D.C. in the United States just are a handful of photographs. They don't really have a full picture of D.C.
Right.
But the photographs they have are extraordinarily intense. He has this Asiatic cast, you know, as Denise said, he kind of looked like a lion.
Okay.
Something fierce and silent and very sensual and very reliable. You know, you would never expect to hear something completely off the wall from D.C. It's just going to make sense.
You talked about your work, and you talked about your work around Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and Marilyn Buck. And there are many people who, like Michael Tabor and D.C. and others, who are in exile, in isolation, incarcerated. And you've been part of that movement along with many others to change that situation. What do we need to do to bring more energy for recognition, for release, for freedom for some of the people?
Well, since this is an older and aging generation, the demands for freedom are stronger among people who are older, because they know who we're talking about, especially somebody like Sundiata Akoli or even Asada Shakur, who's a grandmother. I mean, so we need to broaden and make more mainstream, I think, the acknowledgement and the demands that these freedom fighters be released. They're like Marilyn passing away, like D.C. passing away, like Sotomayor passing away. All those people passed away around the same time, and they were actually all friends. Also more significant, though, I think, that to regroup and think through how do we sustain efforts at liberation for people who are still poor, still marginalized, still politically unrepresented. And that's a significant number of people. So I think those two things go hand in glove, acknowledging the prisoners who struggle for that and finding ways to further that struggle, also acknowledging the contribution of the prisoners and demanding their release.
You know, Kathleen, our very last question, many people who will hear you speaking will probably heard of the Black Panther Party, but may not or may be able to put it in the context of history. What has Kathleen Neal Cleaver gleaned from this last 40, 50 years of life in struggle, lawyer, international affairs, Black Panther Party, writer, thinker? What have you gleaned from this that you can share with us?
I happened to be born into a world that was shifting, that was changing radically. In 1954, for the United States, it was a radical shift that began there with the rejection by the United States Supreme Court of segregation as part of the Constitution. Now, segregation had never been part of the Constitution. It had been repudiated at the end of the Civil War, as meant by making African descendants citizens. But the culture accepted that. So there was a huge cultural shift, also a political shift, beginning in 54, not only in the United States, but also in Africa and in Asia. So I happened to be able to grow up in that time, both in the United States, in Africa, in Asia, and participate fully in the efforts to make real those changes, you know, that come through with the 64 independence movements all over Africa. By 74, the Vietnam War is over, and the world is beginning to change in directions that are more recognizable to people now. So we're part of a revolutionary moment. I was fortunate to grow up in that moment, to be formed in that moment, to understand the world through the lens of repudiating colonialism, white supremacy, and establishing national liberation for colonized people. I mean, this is the reality that was part of my life. For many of the people now, those words don't have the reality. They're just living in the sort of the shadows of that, and I think it's more complicated and more fascistic in a way, because that demand and that compulsion to be free, to be independent, to get rid of imperial rule, white rule, segregation, you know, it's not as imperative now because it looks like it's gone. But it's not completely gone. So we're in phase, the next phase, you know. Power to the people. Continue the struggle.
Kathleen Neal Cleaver joining us to talk with us about Don Cox and about the Black Panther Party, her book she recently edited, Target Zero, A Life of Writing, the collection of Eldridge Cleaver's writing, and Memories of Love and War, which is another project she's working on. She's currently teaches at Emory University, Yale. Kathleen, thanks so much for the time. It's always a grace, a pleasure to talk with you, Kathleen.
Well, thank you.
Take good care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're joined on the line by Mama Charlotte Hill O'Neill. She and her husband, Pete O'Neill, were members of the Black Panther Party who left the States in the early 1970s. They now live in Tanzania, where they are co-directors of the United African Alliance Community Center. And Mama Charlotte graciously joins us as part of this program on D.C. Field Marshal Don Cox, to talk a bit about his life and his work and her remembrances. Mama Charlotte, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, brother. I'm honored to do anything to remember our brother, D.C.
Good. When did you first meet Brother D.C., Mama?
I met Brother D.C. as a 19-year-old young Panther in Algiers, Algeria. My husband and I had just left Kansas City, and we were so welcome into the international section of the Black Panther Party. And Brother D.C. and his wife Barbara and their son Jonathan were from some of the first people that we met, along with Eldridge Cleaver and Kathleen. And what a day that was.
talk about that. People know about the Black Panther Party, but few people know about the international section of the Black Panther Party in Algiers. Give us a sketch of that before we keep continuing talking about D.C.
The international section actually had embassy status there in Algeria. You know, and many people also don't realize that we were all revolutionaries, we were all Panthers, but we were also mothers and fathers, you know? And so many people forget that we had regular lives behind the scenes of where we were continually talking about revolution and living revolution. We also had children. We also had kitchens. We had to cook. We had to live. And we had to have wind down time, you know, where we could all be together and have time to laugh and refresh ourselves. You know, people seem to think that when you're a revolutionary, you're a completely different person. You know what I mean?
Okay.
But there were so many regular aspects to our lives that are always overlooked.
Your first impressions of Brother D.C., of Field Marshal Don Cox?
When I first met Brother D.C., I'd seen pictures of him, but to meet him in the flesh, someone who, as you know, is such a heroic figure, and to see him with this long, wild afro and his Fu Manchu goatee and his smile, you know, and he had such a, when he would smile and the brother would laugh heartily, his eyes would crinkle up, and it was just, he had a really, really good vibe, you know, and he would always be so pressed. His shirts would be all starched and pressed, you know, and he had kind of a little stoop to his walk, you know, and he was just about, I think he must have been around Eldridge's age. So he was one of our elders. And remember, I was just 19, and I think my husband was 31 by then. So I really looked up to him not only as a comrade, but also as an elder.
Now, you knew, that sounds very interesting, that it was yourself and your husband, Pete. It
yes.
was Kathleen and it was Eldridge. It
yes.
was Don and his wife, Barbara, who you knew.
Yes.
And it was Cetewayo and his wife, Connie, I believe.
And there was also Sekou Odinga and his wife, Awode, and their children, Afeni. Yes, it was a large collective, actually.
Okay.
And we lived collectively, but we also had three different houses. I remember we used to all cook together. laugh together. I had my firstborn child there, Malcolm,
in Algeria.
Yes, in Algeria, you know. And I had so much support from the brothers and sisters because I knew nothing about raising a baby. But everyone embraced me. They helped teach me. As a matter of fact, I found the Dr. Spock book in a very extensive library that was there at the headquarters, at the international section. And that, I think I have that book to this day, and this was 40 years later.
Good. And with Michael Setaweo Tabor, both Brother Don Cox and Michael Setaweo Tabor made their transition very, very recently with the with the ancestors, with the Zamani. Talk about Michael, because he was young when he wrote the book, Capitalism Plus Dope Equals Genocide.
He was. And Seth and I became good friends, and he used to tease me because in those days, I mean, I could sing, but they used to tease me, especially Seth, that I tried to sound like Aretha Franklin. And you know, Seth had this booming bass voice. As a matter of fact, when he was in exile in Zambia for all these years, he had a radio program. And I met many people from Zambia who knew and respected his program. And I bet you didn't know, Seth actually was able to come to Tanzania. This was in the 90s.
Okay.
He came to Tanzania, and we hadn't seen him since Algeria. He came and stayed with us at our center for 3 or 4 days, and that reunion was something that I will never forget. Where we could sit around outside under the banana trees and just relax and recall all the things that we had done. Both those brothers have spirits that will be remembered forever and ever.
One of the things, I was reading something from DC's wife, Barbara, when she talked about the process of isolation that had worn on him. His strong brother, the process of isolation. That's what exile is isolation. You're away from your family.
Right.
How do you, because you know Pete, you know Sidwell, you know DC, you know other brothers and sisters who can't be back in the States, who were fought in the liberation movements here. Talk about how you manage that, Mama Charlotte, and what you got from others that helped you manage that.
Yes, brother. Well, you know, our path has been a little bit different. You know, for years and years, we were very isolated, and we became homesteaders, you know, and a lot of our life was filled with that. But after we started the community center, United African Alliance Community Center, things changed because people from all over the world, including some of our family, would come to us. Where Brother Pete didn't have to feel as isolated as he was. And now we have 23 grandchildren is what we call them, 23 children that we're raising. So each day our hearts are really full of activities, of community work, and that feeling of isolation, I think, has just fallen off. And I would dare say that Brother Pete, being in the space and time where he is now, has become a blessing, not only to himself, but to so many youth who he has been able to affect by that spirit of the Black Panther Party, brother. That has kept us buoyed up all these years.
In our last moment here, Mama Charlotte, you carry so many different hats as an artist, a singer, writer, poet, and you always bring spirit. Some words for Brother Seth, Michael Tabor, for Brother Don Cox, and other brothers and sisters who were soldiers in the Army who have made their transition. Some spiritual words from you, Mama Charlotte.
May they know that their memories, their spirits, will always be with us. We will always honor everything that they were, all the positiveness through the work that we continue to do. May they rest well in the arms of the ancestors.
Mama Charlotte, we always appreciate talking with you, and it's very special to talk with you about
Thank you, good friend,
Brother Don Cox and Michael Setaweo Tabor. Take good care and travel safe.
Thank you, brother.
See, in order to have a true cultural revolution, we first must have a true revolution. And the definition for revolution is a complete and radical change. the overthrow of one system and being replaced by another, only after we deal with the economic base, which would be to smash and destroy this capitalist society, could we start talking about a true cultural revolution. People who would like to give other meanings or talk about other types of revolutions, these are the same people that try to propagate the madness that there's no difference between Rockefeller and me. You see, and that's a motherfucking lie, because he's got all the money.
Be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out.
You're listening to KPFA Transitions on Traditions in Africa Today. Greg Bridges and Walter Turner combining forces with you to bring you this special edition of Africa Today and Transitions on Traditions, where we pay memory and honor and respect to Donald L. Cox and Geronimo Jijaga Pratt. With us also is Emory Douglas, Minister of Culture with the Black Panther Party. And Emory, you know, one of the things that led to the destruction and interruption of work that a lot of these community activist groups were doing was COINTELPRO. When did you and the Panthers actually become aware of COINTELPRO, or were you aware of it as it was going on within?
We were aware, but we didn't know what it was called then. We know it was something going on, but we didn't know it was COINTELPRO. You could say early 1967, when you initially in Berkeley, California, when we had our headquarters, and they had this plan that we had gotten, which Bobby Seale said came to him from a from some police officer gave, sent us the tape of the plan that they had to come in to bomb the office, the quarter off the streets, drop tear gas, ambulance prepared to take out the wounded and the dead. And he had these plans, this map that showed this whole plan. And so it was from that initially that we knew that things were happening in the very early stages of mm-hmm. that period. Then there were the situations when you had, they began to take criminal elements, dress them up like Panthers. They would go into stores and threatening the vendors who were making donations to the party in the name of the party. And those vendors who had wanted to were gladly donating foods and produce and different products to the party became fearful, thinking it was us. You know, in reality, it was those elements that the government had made deals with to come in and to create kind of havoc. So it was those kinds of dynamics began to play in relationship to us understanding that there were things happening, but not knowing what they were at that particular time.
Well, as you became aware of some of these counterintelligence activities, What were some of the steps that the Panthers were taking to counter those?
Well, we would inform and enlighten the people through our publication. That's why our power paper was so powerful, so dynamic. We had people who could communicate and express those things in the common language so the average person could understand it, what was going on. At the same time, you had people who were in denial about the fact that we couldn't believe that this would happen in America, could be happening in America at that time. But we were able to do that because we had people who were from the intellectual, could speak on that level. We had people who on the grassroots and the community level could speak in relationship to folks coming and going on a daily basis. Not only that, we had the attention of the mainstream publications, where we're running articles, Rolling Stone, Time Magazine, all these different magazines, Ebony and Essence were also publishing articles by Kathleen Eldridge Cleaver, Bobby Seale, Elbert Big Man Howard, and many, many others.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the other signs of things happening?
Well, other signs of things were happening was the begin to develop mistrust, misinformation that was being played out. For example, I recall the and specifically with Geronimo Jijaga, Huey used to like to hang out with his brother in L.A. and party, and so when he was in L.A., somebody slid under Huey's brother and told him that Geronimo Jijaga was an informant. And Huey's brother told Huey that. So when Huey got out of prison, Panthers wanted to make Geronimo Huey's security. But Huey would say he didn't want him. He wouldn't say why. He didn't want him to be his security. Then he finally said, well, he was an informant. But I swore up and down, because I was asked, David Huey swore up and down that he wasn't. But this information had come through his brother, from this person who slid under his brother and told him that.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, he believed it, you see. So you had that kind of activity that was going on during that time that began to cause mistrust and splits within the organization itself.
That's the voice of our guest today, Emory Douglas, Minister of Culture with the Black Panther Party, as we continue our tribute to Donald Cox and Elmer Geronimo Jijaga Pratt on KPFA Transitions on Traditions and Africa Today.
I was born into a tradition of resistance. My uncle was a part of the UNIA before I was born, Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association. He was a legionnaire. He organized largely in the South. We were born into a situation where the older members of the community, who were usually deacons, a lot was centered around the church, would be the ones to protect the church from Klan violence. The Klan would come, burn their crosses and whatnot. The preachers would preach, be the Martin Luther Kings, and the deacons would be the Malcolm X's, so to speak. Though they wouldn't speak, they would be the ones to protect the church. You may have heard of the Deacons for Defense and Justice and other groups that came about because of that. I was born into that. When I finished our little segregated high school across the track, it was only 17 of us graduated. I wanted to go to Grambling Southern, play football and chase the girls and whatnot. But the elders counseled us and told us that, look, you are the young soldiers now. We have been in Korea and whatnot, World War II, but we're getting old. So you have to fill our ranks. So they advised us to join the army, and we always followed the elders' advice. And that's how I ended up in the army. And I always wanted to make that clear, because I'm not a hypocrite. I don't like people to think things other than I'm a Vietnam vet. I have a lot of comrades who are Vietnam vets. But I didn't join the army out of any sense of patriotism to the United States. I want to make that very clear. I joined because my elders advised me to join. Me, Maxie O'Brien, Frank Francis, Tony Delco, and Jesse Bradford, at that little small swamp town in Lower Louisiana. We met nobody, no ill will. We did what the elders told us to do, because they never told us wrong. So I went and I joined, and within a few months they had me in Santo Domingo, and in a few more months I'm in Vietnam. I mean, as soon as I got in, it didn't stop. Constant warfare. And then Martin Luther King was killed. King was like the God of the older people. And Malcolm was like our God. We were the young, crazy people, okay? But we respected the elders. And when they said we do what they tell us to do, we supported Martin Luther King. And we loved Martin Luther King through the wisdom of the elders. But when Martin Luther King was killed, April 4th, 1968, they sent out a call, the elders, Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, Alabama, Georgia, Florida. This is not a secret. We can talk about this now. We were told to come home, and we came home. They told us, we have to defend these communities. They have killed our king. All hope is lost. So now we got the backing of the elders. So I did my thing. I did what I was told. I went throughout every ghetto, every swamp, every one-horse town that they sent me to, teaching people how to defend themselves, what I had learned in the military. I ended up in Philadelphia, ended up in New York, Chicago. When I come out here to work with a young group called the Black Panther Party, they had no idea. Police were killing them at random. They were standing up and shooting back with half-loaded bullets that they had bought from the surplus store. So I took them and we had classes on how to defend themselves. And for that, I was attacked. That was my role. I had to build the Ministry of Defense, not only for the Black Panther Party. I had to participate in building it for the Republic of New Africa, for the Mau Mau, for the Texas Black Liberation Front, for the Alabama Black Liberation Front, and so many other groups in this country in the 60s. And though I wasn't behind a mic doing it, I didn't hide it, because under international law, we have a right to defend ourselves. And we knew international law back then real well, and we know it more so today. So in the process of teaching, you hear about the shootouts here in Los Angeles and New Orleans and Seattle. Sure, I went there and I told them, I take responsibility for those brothers and sisters doing that because they were following my orders in every corner of the land. Everything we did, I'll take responsibility for it. Don't give me no credit, but I'm the one who put them out there, who trained them to do that. Don't put them in jail. If you think that there's a law being violated, then attack me. Okay, they came at me. I went to trial. We were acquitted. The jury said, no, the police were wrong, because we were basing it on laws that they couldn't deal with. So what do? First, they come with the Tate LaBlanca murders. Y'all know Charles Manson. Charlie wasn't the first arrested for that. I was. They took me down to Newton Street and tried to, you know, scare me and whatnot. And I don't know what they're talking about, you know, because they would do it so often. But the someone had written "off the pig" in blood of the victims on the wall. So automatically all the Panthers did it. Then they come with another murder. That didn't stick. So here come the Olsen's murder. That didn't even stick. Johnny Cochran, if he was here, he's more eloquent than I am. He could tell you in more detail. Stuart Hanlon, who was with me all those years, that even at that trial, with the FBI putting an informant agent in the jail with me, an informant agent in Johnny Cochran's office, this is two, an informant agent on the jury, this is three, and an informant agent who said I did the murder on the stand, this is four. Four paid agents to convict me of this. They almost still lost the case. So they spent a lot of money doing these things. And they did it all throughout the country, targeting certain individuals who they wanted to kill. They shot at me. I got bullet holes all in me. That didn't work. So this worked for them. After that comes the lies and the deceit that people usually go for, because you got high-powered media that tells you that this guy's the quintessence of evil, that he was out for the destruction of all white people. They say when war begins, truth is the first casualty, and that's very true.
It is with great honor and pleasure that we welcome Virginia Jenny Pratt to this program in honor of Geronimo Pratt. Jenny, the older sister of Geronimo, is here to give us a bit of insight. Welcome to KPFA, Jenny.
Thank you.
We all know Geronimo Pratt as Geronimo the Black Panther, Geronimo the Revolutionary, and the political prisoner. But could you tell us more about Geronimo's childhood and his upbringing that that went into shaping him as a freedom fighter?
Well, we were Roman Catholics at that time. And Geronimo was an altar boy, and our father had scrap metal business. And our father would put us in a truck and go out to the nearby plantations and all and give food and clothing to others. So he was brought up in that environment. However, so far as racism is concerned, he knew about that, but he could get along with everyone, because in our neighborhood, it was Arcadians and blacks. Mm-hmm. He was a natural-born leader, and he was also naturally compassionate towards others. Mm-hmm. He would step up, and if necessary, put himself in somebody else's place to take the blame of something that they had done, because he wasn't afraid.
Move forward a bit to Geronimo the Black Panther. Can you tell us about that connection, how his involvement in the Panthers first came to be?
Well, he had met two young men while he was in service. They were the Jackson brothers. And they told him quite a bit about the Panthers. And when he came here, because of his military background, he proceeded to get in touch with the Panthers and sort of teach them some ways to protect themselves. And there was an incident at UCLA where two of the Panther leaders were killed. And at that time, Bunchy Carter was killed, and they asked Geronimo to take his position mm-hmm. as the leader of the Black Panther Party here in L.A.
The feelings that you were having when Geronimo was imprisoned, I mean, for 27 years, you know, his family supported him, stood by his side. Was there ever any time where hope seemed to dwindle?
Yes, every time he had a parole date, he would just be turned down, saying that he was too dangerous to let out. And it was very, very draining, very much so. Sometimes as soon as I would hit the prison gates, I would just be sick to my stomach. You know, it was really horrible.
After all of those years of imprisonment, and eventually it looked like there may be a chance of Geronimo gaining freedom. Tell us about what led to that period and how that was for you and your family.
Well, there is a Minister McCloskey who got on the case, and he was just wonderful. And Attorney Johnny Cochran, oh, he was just so great. And Stuart Hanlon, oh, the most wonderful thing that ever happened to Geronimo. So towards the end, we had high hopes. But I guess we feared going to Orange County.
Right.
And that was the greatest thing. Judge Dickey was such a gentleman. And then one of the highlights is when Johnny Cochran was able to get Julio Butler, who was the informant who had lied all of these years saying that he wasn't. He had written a letter saying that Geronimo had confessed to him that he had shot a lady on the tennis court. And that's why they kept Geronimo in prison for all of those years. And, oh, it was such a joyous occasion when he was set free.
Tell us about that. I mean, that's a joy that a lot of us felt. But we felt it from a distance, seeing it in newspapers, seeing it on you know, television screens. But from your personal experience, tell us about that elation, that joy.
Oh, it was so joyous, and our mother was still alive. He was going to get a chance to visit with her. And the thing about Geronimo, although some of the prisons offered him large sums of money to come and talk to the prisoners, he never set foot again in the prisons. But he had done a lot of meditations, and he found that to forgive and forget would help him in life. So that's the way he was. As soon as he got out, all he was thinking about was helping others. And that's the kind of person he was.
How did you and your family cope? How were you able to survive those 27 years of Geronimo behind bars and maintain your faith and maintain your support?
It was hard, but even when Geronimo was incarcerated, he would find other people who didn't have any visitors, relatives or anything. And at that time, you would get so many boxes a year.
Uh-huh.
And he was constantly sending and helping other people. And a lot of times when I go up there, I would look around and say, didn't I buy that for you? He said, you bought it for me. Yes, you bought it for me. And so if it was mine, I could do what I want with it. He would give it to others, always, even in there, helping others.
So he always maintained his community mindset.
He always did. Now, naturally, there were times when it was very, very depressing and very hard.
Of course.
I said before, our mother visited him once in Folsom, And my God, what they put us through. And we were only able to visit maybe about 10 to 15 minutes. And at that time, he asked me, he said, Jenny, never, ever, ever bring Mama to any prison again. And that was the only time she visited.
And he stayed involved. What was he doing in Tanzania?
Tanzania, he brought water to a village and solar energy. He would go around and find people like in a little village who didn't have a TV. He would give them that. And he was in the United States recently, about 2 or 3 weeks before he expired. And whenever he would come here, he would always go back like Santa Claus. One time he had a whole barge with clothing, medicine, and all kinds of supplies, and he shipped it to Ghana. Then he flew over to Ghana and helped unload it. So he was always doing things to help others.
His memory will help a lot of people. His lessons that he was able to teach others through life, and his legacy will continue helping people. And I want to thank you for the time you spent with us here on KPFA, helping us to remember and see another side of Geronimo Pratt. Jenny, thank you very much.
Okay, I would like to say this, that the way you live is the way you die, and I want to thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to the voice air of Jenny Pratt, who is the sister of Geronimo Pratt, and she's part of this evening's special program talking about her brother, Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt, Elmer Pratt, and also this evening honoring the work of Field Marshal Don Cox, joined in the studio with Greg Bridges, Transition on Traditions, Claude Marks of Freedom Archives, and our special guest, the Minister of Culture of the Black Panther Party, Emory Douglas. And we're going to take a moment here. You said you were visiting Geronimo. Talk a bit about your first meeting of Geronimo and give us a few words here about the type of person that he was, the character.
Well, the first meeting with Geronimo was when we had all the L.A. chapter come up for a visit so everybody would know who they were in early, I believe it was late 1967, early 1968. And I seen him that day along with other comrades who I had never met before. That evening we had a Panther party in San Francisco where we were partying hardy. And so I was going up the hill to the party and Geronimo was leaving out. And it was at nighttime and I spoke. I said, hey, brother. And I introduced myself. I seen you today and my name is Emory and the whole bit. And so later on, he told me that when he seen me that night, and I approached him. He didn't know who I was. He went on the defense. He said, I barely escaped.
Had you been drinking that Bitter Dog, Emory?
Well, I was going to drink the Bitter Dog.
You're gonna drink
that's
bitter.
Where I was headed, to drink okay. The Bitter Dog.
We're going to listen to the voice now of Stuart Hanlon. We are honored to be joined today by Attorney Stuart Hanlon, criminal defense lawyer based in San Francisco, and one of the lead attorneys along with Johnny Cochran during the legal defense and eventual release and exoneration of Elmer Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt. Stuart joins us today to talk about his work and his friendship of more than 25 years with Geronimo Pratt. Stuart, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Walter.
Good. I was reading a book and it talked about your first meeting with Geronimo. Talk about how you find yourself meeting Elmer Geronimo Pratt and why you found yourself meeting Elmer Geronimo Pratt on that visit to San Quentin in 1975.
Okay, well, I was at Columbia in the 1960s and was very overtly political and went to law school to represent people who were, I guess, oppressed at that time or getting messed with by the government. And the Panthers were a big deal in New York, and I was always involved with them even there. And I got connected in law school with the SLA people. Joe Ramiro and Russell Little got arrested, and there were the few people who pretrial would move to the lockup shoe in San Quentin, and they met Geronimo, and I would visit them, and they said, hey, we know this Panther who has no lawyer who got framed, and I said, sounds good to me, so I went to see him. So it was a connection through the SLA, the Sudanese Liberation Army people, and the first visit was quite interesting. It was, I'd never been to a prison before, a jail, let alone San Quentin. And Geronimo was in a security housing unit. And so everybody visited behind a glass. There were about 8 inmates. And he and I had met before, and he came out, and everybody was kind of like hogtied, and they could walk their hand or chain to their waist, and then the chain connecting to their feet so they could barely walk. And all the guys started undoing their chain and getting out of them. And I'm looking at him, and Geronimo said, this isn't a good day to come. And I said, well, sorry. You know, it's like the only day I had. And he said, I'm sorry. He's all he said. And they took their chains off, and he took his chains off, and a guard walked in. And this inmate pulled out a knife and started stabbing him. The guard, they got the guard on the ground. And this didn't come out until years later because Geronimo was in prison. But Geronimo jumped on the guard, looking like he was involved in the assault. But he would, to me, and I was looking at it, I mean, I was like, it's far there from you. He was getting the blows. He was getting cut. He was actually protecting this guy. And that was it was like unbelievable. It was like, I just watched, my face was, stuck to the glass. I couldn't believe this was going on. And of course, I know all these guards came in and started beating everybody up brutally. I mean, it was like, it was an incredible scene. They called the goon squad, came in with these huge sticks and were beating all the inmates. And they had this wounded guy who was bleeding on the ground. And everybody had left the visiting rule, the wall of seats, but me. I was just glued to it. And that's how we first met. And in fact, that guard, Officer M, gave declarations after Geronimo got out of prison that Geronimo saved his life. And they were both Vietnam vets, and they had a bond. Anybody with a vet, I think, had a bond with Geronimo. And but we couldn't talk about it when he was in prison because he would then be considered a snitch. So that's how we developed our relationship and learning about the Freedom of Information Act together. And we learned it together. He had the books I had, and we studied it together. It was amazing experiences. He would say, they framed me. And Johnny Cochran would joke. He would always say to Geronimo, who's they? But I knew who they were. I mean, we had a common language, he and I. And I said, yeah, they did. The man I knew could not have killed some unarmed women or anybody laying on their back unarmed. I mean, he could have killed people in Vietnam. He could have killed people in a shootout. But he couldn't have done that. That was obvious to me. And it still was obvious to me. You know, we learned about his case together. It was a really, right away, I'd get, write to the FBI. And we wrote to every agency we could think of. And we think, of course, we wouldn't find anything. And every agency in the United States government, from the State Department to Army Intelligence to Navy Intelligence, to the CIA, but more the FBI, but all these agencies had documents on him, some of them hundreds of pages, but we couldn't get anything. They just said, we blocked, you get 100 pages and you had 100 words you could read. And we said, hey, something's going on.
When did you think, Stuart, that it was, Geronimo was associated with the Black Panthers,
right,
who at some point were considered to be one of the greatest threats to national security. And many people I've spoken to said that they really didn't know COINTELPRO was going on at that time.
Right.
When did something begin to say to you and Geronimo that this is more than just a regular beat policeman stopping me and harassing me, right, that there's more to it than that?
I think without even talking about it, we had an understanding that it probably was the federal government and the FBI. I think we thought that was possible. But it wasn't until we started getting the documents from the Freedom of Information Act that we began to realize, why are these federal agencies keeping files on a state murder case? You know, what is going on here that we got from the FBI? At one point, we got a notice there were 10,000 pages. We couldn't have any of them. Why would the FBI have 10,000 pages on this guy? Why would the CIA have 400 pages? Why would Navy Intelligence have 300 pages? And so that, without getting the documents themselves, but getting hundreds and thousands of pages blacked out, we knew something was going on. And I don't even think Geronimo understood what COINTELPRO was. But then the church committee came out, so we started reading it and realized this, and we said, this is about us, about him, us being the Panthers. And he was only a footnote in that book, the church committee, but it became obvious that he was much more of a footnote to the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover and the cops.
Why Geronimo? Why Elmer Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt? I mean, right, the Panthers were both national and international at that point. why Elmer Geronimo Jijaga Pratt?
Well, I think, why did they kill Fred Hampton could be a question. Why, you know, I think they realized, I mean, some people may not agree with this, they realized in COINTELPRO that, let's say the national leadership in general, people we don't need to mention, had issues and could be manipulated. I mean, they were doing really, you know, like psychological warfare in the Panthers, and I think they realized that people like Geronimo and Fred could not be manipulated. And then Geronimo, there was an article in LA Times that I read about that was, came out during his trial. It's like it was titled America's Worst Nightmare, a black man who we trained in the military to be not only a weapons expert, but a bomb expert, all the things he learned, comes back and turns it, in their mind, turns it against us, the United States. And I think that really scared them. They realized he was a brilliant military man and had learned all these things and had been so courageous in the military and got all these medals that he was scary. They realized he was the real deal. He was a leader. Fred Hampton was the leader.
What broke the case? What broke the case, Stuart? I mean, Geronimo talks about in one of his speeches, I think it's at Pasadena when he gets out, he said, look, they had an FBI and Johnny Cochran's office. They had informers on this. They had informers on this. He said they had informers just about everywhere. What broke this case? What was the turning point?
Well, the case took 25 years to break. And it wasn't just me and Johnny. There were so many lawyers and legal workers along the way. And so it was a 27-year ordeal. I think in the beginning, getting the Freedom of Information Act documents turned us on that Butler was an FBI informant, because that's what we started seeing. Then we got this Republican Congressman, Pete McCloskey, and he started pushing the government, and we got more and more documents. But we were running up against judges who, to say that the FBI framed somebody or the police framed somebody was a huge decision for a judge to make, and I don't think most judges are capable of it. So we got all this information over the years and kept on losing. I think what changed it was we got out of L.A., where all the judges are very protective of that legal system. We got into Orange County, which we thought was bad, but was good. But ultimately, what really...